The views and opinions expressed by any hosts or guests of WJMS Radio do not reflect the beliefs of its owners or associates. No liability, explicit or implied, shall be extended to WJMS Radio or the show hosts whose words, advice, and or opinions appear from or on our website or on air.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Are we on the air?
You're listening to WJMSRadio.com.
Jam.
This chick is a sick individual.
You're tuned in to Sound Off with your girl Jams right here on WJMSRadio.com.
There is no competition.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Sound Off right here on WJMS Radio. This is your girl, Jams, kicking it with you live from down here in Savannah, Georgia. I am so excited to be with you guys today. This is part two of my roundtable discussion on teachers and COVID. And if you missed last week's episode, you missed a really, really good conversation with a couple of educators from the pre-K, kindergarten, and elementary school levels. But this week, we should have a great conversation as well, as I'm joined by folks from the middle school, high school, and college level now. The conversation just was way too big to put everybody in the same room at one time. And so I decided to split the conversation up by the younger kids versus the younger to older kids, because there is definitely two different types of educational points for these kids that we have to consider in terms of teaching. So I am joined right now by three wonderful people who have agreed to be with me today. Again, like I mentioned last week, I have asked that they do not share the locations at which they teach. I am not interested in anybody losing their jobs or their position. So again, please make sure you don't mention the schools that you're at, but you can talk about where you like what you actually teach and stuff and things that go on in the school. Just don't say the school name. If anybody wants to get in touch with us today, we are streaming live on TuneIn right now for the radio station. Of course, you can always listen on mobile. You can also watch the show if you'd like to. We are on Facebook streaming on the WJMS Radio Facebook page, as well as our WJMS Radio Facebook group. So you can catch the live stream there. And we're also in StreamYard. If you would like access to the studio, let me know. You can hop in and actually speak with us live on air. But in the meantime, please feel free to drop a comment on any of those platforms and I'll be able to insert it into conversation as best I can based on what we're talking about. But I want to jump into the show for today because I have a very, very full list of questions to ask these folks. So first and foremost, I'm going to go through, give the biographies for everybody with me today, and then I'm going to give them the opportunity to expound on where they are, where they came from, and just what brought them to teaching in the first place. So the first person I'm going to do the bio for is Brian Carter, who is a ninth grade STEM facilitator. And right now he is a native to Philadelphia, and he aspires to become the world's first video game therapist, which is really cool. We'll talk about that also. He also uses applied behavioral analysis to foster skill acquisition and suicide prevention within children and adults. Brian uses his therapeutic video game research to help individuals better understand themselves, their schema, and personal filters for new information and how to teach themselves new information. So the next person right next to him on my, I guess, my right-hand side would be Steve Tyson, who is a freshman teacher in a, I'm not going to say the college, but he's a college freshman teacher. And he is a musician, an educator, and an activist. He's the founder of Just Listen Entertainment, which is a multimedia arts company that promotes critical thinking and freedom of artistic expression through hip hop culture. As an educator with over 20 years of experience in youth development, he's currently an adjunct professor and also earning an EDD in educational leadership. Say that three times fast. He's also a hip hop artist. He performs under the name Elect. He's got over a million streams across his digital platforms. He writes and produces his own music, in addition to composing music for shows like Star Talk Radio on Sirius XM. And last but not least is Akil Parker, who is an adjunct professor as well, teaching math education courses. He also teaches math courses for adult learners. He's the founder of All This Math LLC, which is a company that offers private math tutoring and mathematics educational consulting. Prior to this, he had a 14-year career as a high school math teacher at various charter and public schools. He's taught math and history in Upward Bound programs, as well as several extra curricular programs as well. He's a graduate of both Morgan State University with a BS in finance and Lincoln University with a master's in education and educational leadership. He has 5 children who are heavily influenced in the necessity for education as a vehicle for the acquisition of power by people of the African descent globally. And he's affiliated with several organizations that have helped shape his socio-political and cultural awareness, such as the Association for the Study of Classical African Civilizations, the African Heritage Studies Association, and the All African People's Revolutionary Party. He also writes for multiple newsletters, periodicals, and various topics relevant to the global African community. So, mouthful, lots of amazing resumes on you guys. I am really, really excited to welcome you all to the show. Thank you guys for being with me today. I'm going to start, you know, with Brian, since I did your introduction first, and give you an opportunity to just give us a little more background on who you are and what brought you to teaching in the first place.
So one, thank you for inviting me, Jay, and also good afternoon now to the other gentlemen, Akil and Steph. So Brian Carter, I'm the founder and publisher of Main Course BHL. We are an arts and entertainment lifestyle publication based out of Philadelphia. Jamie was there when I first started it back in 2013, been around for 7 years, yep. Covering fashion, music, music, politics, a number of happenings in Philadelphia. What led me to teaching was the fact that my family is our educators. I knew it was only a matter of time. People kept giving me the hint, telling me I was going to get into it. I saw opportunity with arcades and video games at another school, Tech Fieri. And then they asked me if I wanted to be a teacher. And I had the opportunity to design my own curriculum titled Media Arts. And here we are today.
Okay. Yeah. And I've been around Brian since before Main Course was even a thought, which is interesting to think about, but you've also been around since before WJMS was a thought. So we got some history, you and I. It's pretty cool. The next person, I'll go over to Steve, who I did the interview or did the biography for a second, give you an opportunity to give yourself some more background and some more information on where you came from and how you got to teaching in the first place as well.
Thanks, Jams. Similar to Brian, actually, I got into education through having parents who were both educators. It's interesting that the three guests on this call are also Black male educators, because only 2% of all educators in the country are Black men. We're really well represented in this conversation, despite not being represented nationally. But yeah, so I started really just as a summer camp and after school counselor, working with kids and then connected with them on a personal level, realized how much that can affect their academics. And as I got older and started tutoring college, high school and then college students, just became more formal. So now formally teaching young college first year students, in addition to helping to oversee programming at a variety of different K-12 schools here in Philly.
Awesome. All right. And Akil, you're next, last but not least.
So as you said on my bio, I have a finance background. Well, I shouldn't say I have a finance background. I have a finance degree. Mm-hmm. And then with that finance degree, I started working as a bank examiner for the FDIC. And that didn't last long at all. So that lasted about a year. And actually, that brought me to Philly from Baltimore. I was in Delaware, but then I lived in Philly. And then when I left that job after a year, I started tutoring part-time for an agency. And then that agency also placed substitute teachers in different charter schools around the city of Philadelphia. So I ended up with an opportunity to take a long-term substitute position back in 2005, in fourth quarter, teaching 10th grade geometry. And I went out for a day. And then I went back the second day, and then the owner of the company said, you know, if you want to stay on long term school year, you can, you know, think about it over the weekend. And I did. I thought about it, and you know, I kind of did some soul searching, I guess you would say, and I thought to myself that, you know, if I, you know, really try to try this thing called teaching, I might be able to do it one day. And a lot of time for a long time, I was pushing back on it because my father was a teacher. And so I think as part of my teenage angst, I never wanted to be a teacher, partly because, you know, I didn't want to follow in, you know, my father's footsteps. So, you know, I kind of took that opportunity seriously with the long-term substitute position, and I've kind of just never looked back. And, you know, I kind of fell into teaching, and I'm glad I did. Like I tell people, I never wanted to be a teacher. So, and here I am, you know, 15 years later, I'm still teaching, you know, I'm on a college level, I'm trying to train teachers how to teach so they can benefit from all the mistakes that I've made over time, and running a math tutoring business and educational consulting company. So,
all right. And we're going to put a pin in that because you said you're teaching teachers how to teach. And I want to talk a little bit about how that has changed in this landscape, because you got to be a lot more creative nowadays to teach, especially this year. So I want to talk about how that has shifted for you a little bit and what changes you've made. But for now, we're just going to put a pin in that, and I'll come back to it in a minute. The first thing I want to ask you guys, or sort of give a statistic for, and I gave this last week as well, is this idea that ABC News released a poll last week that said 55% of American parents were against schools reopening for in-person instruction in the fall, and only 44% of parents said they'd be willing to send their kids back if schools did open for in-person instruction, despite only 59% of them saying that they were concerned that their kids were falling behind in school. So what you're seeing with that statistic is, I think, what we're all thinking. Like, everybody wants the schools to be open. Nobody is comfortable yet at sending their children back, but everybody's concerned about their progress as they're learning. And that's one of the things that I want to break down, especially on the middle school and the high school and college side, because middle school and high school is still kind of like, you still your K through 12, but in college, it's a lot more different because now you're sending your kids away. You're not just sending your kids to school and then bringing them home at the end of the day. You're sending your kids like away and you're putting them in another atmosphere, another environment. And so I think there's a lot of parents who are nervous about that. And a lot of folks that I've been talking to just in the course of the last couple of weeks are like, yeah, no, I wouldn't be sending my kids back to school. Even my own mother was like, yeah, no, you wouldn't be going to school if you were of school age and it was going on right now. And so I want to find out from you guys, I guess, like, what are some of your thoughts about how students are going to cope with, you know, not actually being able to go to college? Like, so I guess this is only for maybe just for Steve, because the rest of you folks are not college professors. But what is your thought about how these kids are going to cope with that? Because, I mean, I feel like, you know, you look forward to going to college. When you're in high school, like senior year, it's like, yeah, I'm about to pack up and, you know, have my little trunk party in the park and everybody can give me stuff for college. And these kids are now rethinking their entire college plan. So what are your thoughts on that altogether as a college educator and coming from this background? And, you know, we went to the same school and all that kind of stuff. So just talk about what your thoughts are on that whole entire statistic.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough because you every point you made is absolutely valid. I mean, you have so many students who are really excited to get away from home to start to, I guess, begin to define who they are as adults and who they are as individuals. And to do that in a virtual space is very different, to say the least. And so from my perspective, I think that since at the university I teach at, there's not going to be any in-person instruction for this fall, really thinking about what are ways that we can build community as a class, but then also still have opportunity for students to get out into the local community, whether it's the area in which the university is located or the big city right next to it. I mean, there's a lot of opportunity for folks to still get out, get explore, build community, get to know one another, even though those late night hangouts and just, you know, eating food at the dining hall and you know, just all that kind of community space is really limited. I was really trying to find ways of still building that community, but it's also difficult too, because I mean, this is the first full year that most institutions are, you know, if they haven't been on fully online already, are, you know, approaching this type of method. And so it's almost building the plane as you fly it. But for me, my primary focus is still trying to drive as much community building and individual development as possible for these first year students.
Yeah. And I think to go along with that, what I thought about as soon as you said that, you know, we got Lincoln University graduates, we got Cheney. So all the HBCUs, a big part of your college, like, just experience is being around your people. You know, like, that's the biggest part of being in an HBCU, is being surrounded in education by people that look like you. And so I'm constantly thinking about those poor kids who are, like, you know, ready to go to an HBCU and they're not going to get that experience, you know. And I think everybody on the conversation today can speak to that a little bit and talk about, you know, what that would mean, you know. And I mean, I know Brian, I know Steve, you guys both have HBCU experience. Akil, I can't remember. Did you say, I think you do have HBCU experience?
Steve. As a student or a professor?
Either or, you know, like, I mean, as a professor is even more interesting because you're teaching, you know, a class full of children that look like you, which I think is even more, you know, amazing. But as people that all have experience dealing with HBCUs, you know, how do you think that this is going to fit? I mean, there's talk of a lot of colleges that are not opening. There's a lot of colleges who are going bankrupt and not able to open their doors because they just can't support, you know, an online learning sort of environment. So, I mean, in your opinion, this, it's not the end of HBCUs, of course, but like, do you think that, you know, some of these more important ones are going to survive this, I guess, is the question that I want to ask you guys.
So to go back to your original question, you said, how are students going to cope? I think short term, you know, they were expecting to go back to school. Now, at least my students, they know that they're actually not going back. For some students, it's been traumatizing. We have already had a student talk about how they want to check themselves out, and we had to jump on that real quick, and that was announced on social media. I know for me, I've been speaking with the students on social media, Instagram and stuff, just to feel them out, see what they're experiencing, if there's anything that I can do, at least from my end, having a publication. And as far as you said, is going back to school, absolutely not. I don't see us going back to school. I don't suggest we go back to school. We have enough cases, enough evidence, enough empirical information to show us that this isn't a wise decision to make, at least for the students. So at least for the students. As far as the HBU experience, nothing compares. I mean, nothing compares to linking up with your homies and there's 11 of y'all freshman year. Y'all still getting to know each other. Y'all squad deep in the calf. Nothing compares to that. Having that your roommate for 3 years, you know what I mean? And he hood and you a nerd, and but y'all mesh. You see what I'm saying? Being around an environment where people are really honed in and everybody looks like you. You're honed in on making yourself better. It's an open door policy as far as exchanging information and networking and things like that. Like, people are there to build, to improve, to repair, to be better than what they were. And you're talking about now, let's say for the first time worldwide, a generation of students will not be able to experience that.
Yeah. And I think the main thing that hurts me is the fact that we're already losing our first place. You know, like, it's not being taught in schools already. So you really get that culture and that good education, that good history in a HBCU. And to see that, you know, they're going to suffer for this, it's just like, we were already behind the eight ball. This doesn't help. You know, so that was my main concern with that. But I want to jump back a little bit and talk a little bit about this past school year, because as educators, I know it was a lot. You know, a lot of these schools, most of the schools shut down quickly, and all of a sudden you all had to transition to an online, you know, platform. So for teachers, it's already difficult because you have lesson plans set up, you've got group projects, you have things already geared up and ready to go, and then everything shuts down and you have to go to learning and revamp your entire sort of lesson plan. So when the schools first shut down for you guys, you know, how did your school, or how soon was your school able to get back up and running with online courses, or how soon were you, I guess, able to get back up and running with online courses for your students? And, you know, what did that look like for you? You know, did you have to change your entire lesson plan, or were you able to tweak as easy as, you know, or easily, I guess?
This past school year, I was teaching at three different locations, the two colleges, and also the night school program for adult learners. And so there was a shift to virtual learning, and it was, to be honest, it was rough. You know, it was just, there were a lot of moving parts, a lot of variables. And,
yeah,
you know, I think we did the best we could with the resources that we had. And, you know, so as teachers and administrators, there was a learning curve. So then, you know, there's just a lot of learning curves, you know, combined learning curves, where traditionally it's usually the teachers and the administrators, they're not on as much of a learning curve about just basic structural issues. And, you know, the students are coming in and they have their own learning curves, but now it's like everybody's on a learning curve. So, you know, it was a challenge. And but for me, it was like, one thing that did benefit me was that I was getting more experience because I was working at, you know, three different places, teaching at three different places. And there was like an overlap of some of the things I was doing, like in terms of, okay, I know I'm using Zoom at this school. Now I'm using Zoom at this school as well. So I'm basically like getting more, I guess, as you could say, reps in, you know, I'm getting more experience with using Zoom. And then, you know, in terms of an online platform, you know, one school I'm using Canvas, and then I'm learning how to navigate that. And then I'm also learning, okay, well, what is, you know, what do the students appreciate the most? Like, do they want, you know, more contact or more engagement? Want, you know, emails on a daily basis, you know, kind of, you know, it was all those like things that we take for granted when we're teaching in person. I wasn't able to take for granted anymore. So, and I hope that, you know, when, you know, because one of the schools I work at, one of the colleges, we start on Monday. And, you know, I'm hoping to have learned from some of those experiences from the spring in terms of having a, you know, a better start, you know, for the fall than you know, than things were when we made the transition in the springtime.
Definitely. Brian, Steve, whichever one of you guys wants to hop in next.
I mean, so for me, it was, at least on the collegiate level, it was a bit of a respite because I wasn't already teaching in the spring. I only pretty much teach in the fall. So I was able to take my syllabus and immediately start retooling it for a digital space. But as a program director for this other organization, though, I mean, we're involved, you know, leading different programs in 18 different schools in the Philly Public School District. And so whenever the district went digital, we had to scramble as best as possible to not just create programming for our teams that were going into schools and helping to support students, but then also trying to align them as best as possible with whether it's district regulations and guidelines around virtual space or getting certain access and permissions to Google Classroom and to digital platforms that where the students were getting their academic instruction. It was just a lot of just navigating on the fly. And it took us a few months to, maybe I would say it took us not a few months, maybe a few weeks, probably about 5 or 6 weeks before we really had the ball rolling and were able to implement some sort of service that was effective. But, you know, we're now trying to take some of those best practices and even looking at some of the challenges from the previous semester and trying to identify ways that we can best enter these schools, you know, digitally enter these schools and make sure that we're supporting our students and our teachers as best as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think that it's, and I don't want to say easier, but like, I know for those folks that were teaching already, it's like you had to scrap everything you had and start all over again and tweak everything. Yep. So you were teaching in the fall, probably made it a little bit easier to like, okay, we're doing it this way now. All right, let me start over, you know, whereas with teachers who are already in the midst of teaching, it's like, you have to figure out how to now tweak your lesson plan to fit, you know, an online, you know, digital learning atmosphere, which I think is probably very difficult. But Brian, how about you? How long did it take you guys to get sort of running with online learning in your classroom?
So our school, we basically already had a virtual classroom space that we had constantly used, we referenced, I will always bring it up in class, was used everywhere. So the transition to virtual learning, it was just like that. Like you flick on the switch. But that's how I perceive it and that's how I feel about it. We're not talking about a veteran that's been in the field for 30 years that maybe has not used a lot of technology, that's really hands-on. I'm very and extremely mindful of their transition because, you know, technology is a scary thing. The way that my students use Instagram and the way that I use Instagram, totally two different ways. You know, so that right there tells you that having a veteran teacher that may not be privy to technology, then you expect for them to be able to handle utilizing all these resources, classroom management and stuff like that. It's a completely different situation when you're being virtual. So for me, like I said, on a personal level, it was real easy. The school clicked over just like that. But trying to use all the resources, you know, now you personalizing this experience, I think that was the most difficult for the teachers as I listened to them.
You're the first person I've talked to, Brian, that said that it was like seamless almost. But you're also the first person to say you guys already had a digital classroom space. So I guess you guys were already kind of prepared. But how did this affect your grading, you know, on for each of you guys? I heard a lot of teachers, you know, last week when I was talking to the pre-K and elementary school, who everybody went to pass-fail because it just wasn't logistical for them to be like, you know, you didn't put effort in on this one or you turned this in late because not all the students are working at the same level and not everyone has the same resources, especially in some of these school districts where kids didn't even have computers. It's like, how do you grade these kids when they can't even access the classroom? You know, so a lot of the elementary school teachers and pre-K and all them all switched to pass-fail grading. I know middle school and high school is a little bit different because like Brian said, you guys kind of already into a digital sort of learning experience a little bit. So like, I just want to know if this whole shutdown in the spring semester affected the way that you guys grade in any way.
So to keep it extremely brief, it was nerve-wracking. First, you had to account for the intellectual currency that was in the home. Then you had the technology that was there and then a number of distractions. So that right there. And then you're asking students to step into what I feel is a collegiate work ethic in high school. it just wasn't working. So I had to be mindful of what was actually work and what was actually just a, like a lecture or some component, and just always being extremely mindful of what their at-home experiences was, because they had to work, they had the ecosystem and everything else that was a byproduct of COVID learning.
What happened on my end was I started to put a lot more weight on participation and effort, and giving students the benefit of the doubt in these situations. And you know, it's difficult because I had to check myself on several occasions, because there are a lot of things that I would take for granted, because I'm looking at, you know, my own home situation where I have a dedicated space to go to my laptop and, you know, kind of sit, you know, quietly. And if, you know, my daughter is running around and, you know, making noise, I can easily tell her, like, you know, go upstairs. You know, I need to be quiet down here on the first floor. But I'm not initially thinking about the fact that that's a luxury that everyone doesn't have. So all of that has to be taken into consideration, especially in terms of grading, because I don't think that, you know, people shouldn't be penalized for not having, you know, just a comfortable workspace. You know, a place where they can just think, you know, and, you know, have, you know, think deeply and not be distracted by a lot of other things going on. And also at the same time, it's like, you know, I think it's difficult to hold people accountable and to the same standard, you know, in a very new situation like COVID-19 pandemic. You know, I've been alive 40 years. I've never lived through a pandemic. I don't know what that's like. I don't know if anybody else has. So for all of us. So I think that some type of balance. Well, actually, I don't even know if there can be a balance. I don't even want to say that. I don't even think there can be a balance in this type of extreme situation. I think it's going to have to be skewed. And I think, but if it's skewed, it should be skewed to the benefit of the students while still trying to provide them, because it's not all about a grade. It's really about them learning. So, you know, trying to figure out what's the best way to expose them to as much content, as much information as possible, you know, and then, you know, and then again, it goes back to what I said earlier, like, you know, us defaulting more to effort and participation.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, I definitely agree with both statements that both brothers made. I mean, I think that institutionally, we also went pass fail, but then even think about the, you know, if you remove the expectation of the getting an A or getting a B or, you know, striving for that C, it's like, you have a better opportunity just to connect students with the material itself. And how does that material align with things that are of their personality or that interest them or that may interest them and they don't even know yet? But it kind of takes away some of that, that old, I don't know if it's archaic or not, but definitely that structure away from, you know, the aspiration to get a letter grade and more about the aspiration to want to learn, absorb information and have knowledge of self as well.
I love that.
What I'm over here looking at is my books as you all talking, because you all bringing up some very powerful things. I started to see some of that when I was teaching. So I'm very animated. I like having personality. I got a little intro for my class, a little outro for my class. I play music. I use a lot of multimedia videos, social media, stuff like that. And that's what I use to keep the students in class. To touch on the part about participation, I had students that were mutes, but they speak up in person. So that was the counteraction that I saw with COVID learning. And then also what I haven't heard anybody bring up yet was our SPED babies, our SPED students. You know, you all are educators, so I know you all have encountered them in some capacity. For me, it was a bit debilitating because of some of the reasons I mentioned before, not having intellectual currency at the home or just not having support at the crib, making sure that our lessons were appropriate, which they do on their own. Then we were talking about grading. You have some students that are just naturally quiet or just naturally do not speak in class. So as you were saying, Steph, about skewing the grading, or both brothers skewing the grading, we had to do that. There were just personality changes that are not present in those spaces.
Yeah, 100%. And my thing is, I talked about the special needs students in the elementary and pre-K side of things. And they, you know, they were saying that people had town halls about whether or not to, you know, bring them back, because there's a lot of kids that needed like that get special treatment coming into the classroom, you know? And it's like, how do you now get that treatment to those kids who like, who have, you know, maybe occupational therapy or speech therapy, and they come in and they like, you know, they take the kid out or they interview or they sit, you know? So it was like one of those things where it's like, how do you now get those services to those children and make sure that they're not falling behind? Because I worry that's like, you know, they're all getting lumped in with everybody else. You know, they should be their own distinct, you know, circle of students that is talked about separately from everybody because they have an entire separate, you know, way of learning. And they're just getting, it's like, it's just students. It's just everybody's lumped in together. And it's like, you worry about how they're going to fare with everything that's going on. And so the one thing I did mention on my last conversation with them as well was this idea that like, I know when I was working from home and, you know, it's like, you're on Zoom and you're on conference calls. And it's, for me, I felt like I was plugged in 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Like I felt like there was no clocking out. Like there was no lunch break. You know, there was no like, hey, I'm off duty. It was like, you're on duty all day, every day. And I know as teachers, you guys already are one of the professions where work follows you home. No matter what you do, you got to grade papers, you got to make assignments, you got to do lesson plans. You have all of these things that follow you outside of the classroom. And so I asked each of one of my teachers last week, and I want to ask you fellows as well, did you have an opportunity at some point to ever really unplug, you know, last semester and have a moment to kind of just breathe? And did you find yourself getting overwhelmed? Did you find yourself having to check in with yourself and your mental health to make sure that you were okay? Because I know that like as teachers, you were probably 24/7, even more plugged in than you were before. So what did that look like for you in terms of making sure your mental health stayed where it needed to be during the last semester or the last school season, if you will?
I guess for me, that's something that I'm still attempting to be as mindful of as possible. Yeah, like we've got the pandemic, we've got our students that we're concerned about, you know, to some extent, depending on where we're at, you know, we have our own jobs and finances that we're thinking about. There's family stuff going on, whether, you know, personally having very close family members get infected by COVID and watching their struggle and ultimately recovery, thankfully, from that. But then there's just a million things going on. And so in the midst of all that, whether it's trying to find, you know, a half hour to go take a walk or, you know, just some space and respite in the morning whenever it's quiet, not turning on the news and just sitting on my balcony and watching the birds fly by, like any... Yep. You know, sense of peace and calm, just because whenever my eyelids are open in the midst of all this, is always something that's drawing me or catching my attention or pulling my emotions. And it definitely takes its toll outside of just the genuine day to day of being Black. So, yeah.
Yeah.
With me, I just, you know, I'm glad you bring that question up, because with me, I have a bad habit of, it causes me to be self-reflective, because I have a bad habit of just working until I crash. Mm-hmm. And that's something I need to think more about going forward, because in the spring it just was like, okay, you know, I looked at it as having the same responsibilities, but just, you know, looking at it through just a different platform or a different modality. But in retrospect, it really wasn't that. It really was added responsibility, because on top of what I was already responsible for in terms of instructional delivery, I still had to learn how to deliver on a more consistent basis. So that just compounds the situation, and the work is piled on in terms of that. I guess fortunately, this all went down kind of like during spring break or after spring break. So the semester wasn't that much time left in the semester. When in the night school program I was working in, there was like an abbreviated module. So the module was shortened. So we didn't have the typical 14 weeks. It was shortened to only 7 weeks. So that was helpful. But yeah, I never took the time to really breathe. I just kept trying to just, you know, go with the flow. And then when I wasn't, you know, and I was still tutoring, like tutoring picked up a lot because students were home and the students needed, you know, they had more availability during the daytime hours, whereas typically I can only offer tutoring on weekend, but now students were in the house. So, and then I was doing like Instagram live videos, working out math problems live for students that were sending them in. That was something, you know, a model that I was experimenting with and trying to develop. So no, I never kind of, you know, checked on my own mental health, but I guess I never have, like in my whole teaching career. And I guess it's challenging because while there is stress in teaching, I find that I'm energized by the act of teaching. So it's almost like it's like a double-edged sword. It's like the thing that does, that creates the stress also relieves the stress at the same time. Like if I'm having, like, you know, I might have an issue or argument with my wife or something, or years past, if I had issue, you know, an issue or argument with somebody. But when I get to school in the morning and I see those students, and I'm like, okay, like, you know, those issues and those problems don't matter because, you know, I'm here with my people, you know. You know, I can settle my differences, you know, with, you know, whomever at a later time. But yeah, that's challenging. That's something for me to think more deeply about, like in terms of like how to unplug or when to unplug, or how do you unplug when, like, being plugged? How do you unplug when being plugged in is a stress reliever in itself?
Yeah, for me, I found that, like, I tried to section off my house a little bit. Like, I made my bedroom my bedroom. It was like I didn't answer emails in the bedroom. I didn't answer work calls in the bedroom. It was just like when I went in there, it was like work off, you know. And because it's like otherwise, and you just, you're all over the place. You're answering emails on the toilet, like you're everywhere working. And it's like you have to section yourself off a part of your house where you're just like, okay, I'm off work, you know. Like at some point, it's like, you know, you leave work and you're like, okay, I've left work, work is done. But like when you're working from home, leaving work means you need to find a safe space in your house where it's like work shuts off. And so for me, I just, like I said, I try to make that my bedroom because I'm like, I need something. Like, I got to unplug somewhere or do something. But Brian, how about you? What was your mental health like during this last semester?
So I literally only had to teach for 1 hour a day. Literally only had to teach for 1 hour a day. I think I lost my mind trying to figure out what else I needed to do for school. It wasn't really that bad for me, but most of my issues and concerns then evolved from COVID. So I was more pressured to spend more time. I was more expected, and it's from family. I was more expected to pick up that slack that society had been picking up. So that's where most of my dilemma came from. Now, the increase in responsibility as far as being a family member versus the shift in responsibilities as far as being a teacher goes. My only thing was, as a teacher, just being worried about, yeah, just everybody else, making sure everybody else was cool. At that point in time, I hadn't really realized the magnitude of other people's realities and some of the things they had to deal with. I'm just really skipping through the grass like, oh, this ain't really that deep. Then you hear about in Florida where they have blackout zones. So not only can they not do virtual learning, if they do not have education in any capacity, their kids are going to experience a setback. And then, you know, English as a second language. So it's a number of things. And on a personal level, like I said, it wasn't that deep. But to consider everybody else's experience during this time right now, and as it's still ongoing, that is what added stress to me. Because I'm trying to figure out at least how can I create guidelines or give people a sense of stability as we all continue to walk into COVID learning.
Yeah. And so I want to start to transition a little bit towards the upcoming school year and what's going to happen for this 2020/2021 school year. Weirdly enough, I was at a school yesterday and it was a high school, middle school, and the high school, they were like, yeah, classes start August 5th, which was like the Wednesday. I was there on Thursday. That was the day before. I'm like, whoa, classes had already started. I mean, I'm in Georgia, mind you, and we turned all the way up in Georgia. Well, Atlanta is turned up. Savannah's quiet. But they already started school like on Wednesday. And there were like some kids who had masks on, some kids who didn't have masks on. And there's already statistics floating around that about, I think, 6,300 cases of COVID can now be linked to over 270 private and public, you know, education houses, like whether it's a college or a school. And as of Wednesday, I believe, of this week, it was 14 deaths so far. And school has just started. So for me, it's just like, I worry about not only just the kids, but the teachers. You know, like, everybody's talking about, oh, the kids got to go back. Y'all forget that there's grown men and women that have to go and teach these kids. You know, what kind of provisions are we putting in place to protect the teachers? Because then what happens when a teacher gets COVID? Now they got to be out for 2+ weeks. Now we got a substitute that comes in. Now you're interrupting the students' learning again, because we all know substitute teachers can't always pick up where the main teacher left off with the lesson plan, you know? So it's like you're interrupting kids for another 2+ weeks just because you failed to put provisions in place to protect the teachers. And then they're like, well, when the kids are in the classroom, you know, as long as they're 6 feet apart, they can take off their mask and talk, you know, but it's just like, okay, what if, you know, somebody in that classroom has it and they give it to the teacher? Now that teacher is now infecting everybody that comes into the classroom. Like, that teacher is the one common denominator. And so, like, while I feel like kids are the one of the most important parts of this, there really needs to be a special emphasis put on the safety of the teachers, because they're the one common denominator in all of these classrooms. And if something happens to the teacher, it's going to spread. So for me, as or not for me, but for you guys, as, you know, professors and teachers and educators and people that are in these classrooms, what concerns do you have? I mean, not to talk about or to mention if any of you guys have pre-existing conditions, but like, what kind of concerns do you guys have if there should be, you know, reason for you to go back into the classroom this year? And has your school district actually said that you guys are going to be going back into in-person? I know some of you said that's already online, but in the off chance that that switches in the next 3-4 months, because they might be like, hey, things are great, we're going to move to an in-person, you know, type of atmosphere. What kind of concerns does that raise for you guys as you know, teachers and educators in these spaces? Do you feel like you would be safe in your classroom? The looks on your face tell me all I need to know.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. My school, we had a conversation about if going back in the building would be a wise decision. Automatically, a lot of us said no. A lot of my facilitators, they cited pre-existing conditions and whatnot. And one of the founders of my school cited the fact that I am not looking forward to that phone call where I gotta basically, like, I gotta bury one of my facilitators. I gotta bury one of my staff members because I decided to blitz them through COVID learning. I decided to use them as cattle because that's how I would feel. Unless you're coming from the mountaintop and you're gonna be right down here in the woods and in the field working with me, then yeah, maybe I can feel some type of way. But when you hear millionaires and you hear large business owners talk about, well, death ain't about nothing, COVID ain't about nothing, you've clearly identified how you view me. And I do fully understand that there are some spaces, like I said, in Florida, that there are a blackout zone. They do not have access to the internet or virtual learning. How do we deal with that? So they really have some real issues that they have to deal with. But yeah, I don't feel like cattle. I would feel like cattle. I feel like my life isn't valued. What I bring to the table is overlooked. And we already have empirical evidence that supports that teachers get COVID, whether or not it's them rotating out of the classroom and the students remaining, or the students rotating out of the classroom and the teachers remaining. It's going to happen. It's going to happen.
Steve, Akil, you guys have anything to add?
I mean, for myself, I'm all about, you know, students first. And so whenever it comes to just the health and safety of students, I don't advocate putting them at risk of anything. Thinking about the teachers, staff, administration in any of these institutions, I mean, you know, these are our folks who are on the front line, you know, as far as willing to, you know, shape the minds of the next generation. It sounds euphemistic, but it's true. And so it's just like, you know, what seriousness are we really taking about just the intellectual brain power of future generations if we're shoving people into situations that not only could affect them health-wise, but, you know, the quality of the education and the quality of the learning that they're getting, you know, in an in-person space where there's just a lot swirling around, there's a lot of class movement, there's a lot of restructuring. Are we going to do 2 days a week out of 5 days? There's just so much hypothetical, and it's just like, I don't think that it's worth the risk in any scenario, health-wise, emotionally, mentally.
Yeah.
There's no silver lining that I see in any of it.
I agree. I definitely agree. And Akil, do you want to jump in? I don't know if you have an opinion on this section or not. I mean, as a tutor too, like, I mean, there has to be a level of complication for you. You're not going into anybody's homes. Obviously you're doing virtual tutoring, I would assume, but how is this, how are you feeling about this?
But with the tutoring, like, that was already in transition before COVID into more virtual learning, because it cuts down on travel time. And, you know, some parents and students were more comfortable with that anyway. So that was a smooth transition. But one of the colleges I'll be teaching at, both of the courses I'll be teaching at are both fully online at the one college. But then the other college I'll be working at, the courses, at least in the beginning, they will be in person. They will be traditional. So I'm just looking forward to practicing social distancing guidelines to the best of my ability. I'm just hoping for the best. You know, similar to, I guess the way I rationalize it in my mind is, I just hope for the best the same way I do when I go to the grocery store, or if I have to go to Target or to the laundromat. Just try to be safe and just, you know, minimize my interpersonal interaction. But then, you know, but at the same time, I'm, you know, I have to also take into consideration the fact that it's not real teaching. You know, I can't do the teaching that I've, you know, grown accustomed to. I can't really engage my students the way I've been accustomed to engaging students, like, over the years. So, but, you know, these are extreme circumstances. So we have to, you know, make adjustments in these extreme circumstances and try to, I guess, you know, do the best we can in the situations that we find ourselves in. And hopefully in the future, things can get back to us being able to really be human and really, like, be able to really be social beings the way we once were. That's what I'm hoping for in the future. I don't know when that's going to happen, but, you know, I'm hoping that it does happen again. Cause right now this is like Aldous Huxley, New World. That's what this is, you know, that we're kind of dealing with right now.
So do you guys feel like, you know, you're all voicing very real concerns that I've heard across the board from most professional educators. You know, do you guys feel like your voice would be heard if you were to take these concerns to administration or you know, whoever? Do you feel like you would be penalized for, you know, anything like that? Have they even talked about what the options might be? Because I know in some of these schools, they're giving parents the choice for their children's education of doing either virtual learning, remote learning, or traditional learning, or some combination, hybrid combination of the two or three or whatever. Have they given you guys that option? Like, if you're not comfortable with coming in person to teach, you know, you can create a virtual classroom or something like that. Has that been presented to you guys? Or if you voiced your concerns, do you think that would be presented to you guys?
I mean, it's been presented in my circumstances, it's been presented. And even if it wasn't, I could tell you right now that I'm making sure that I would have the, you know, health and safety to continue teaching kids beyond just this year. So if there were no guidelines, or if I were pushed to be in person, then I have no problem pushing back.
We got a fighter. We got an activist. No, you are an activist. So what about you, Brian?
I'm exactly the same way. Yeah, I mean, absolutely not. So even just to go on the three options that you said, right? Traditional, virtual, and hybrid, that work effort, that work still falls on the educator. So then you would expect for me to create a hybrid model and then also a virtual model, maybe an in-person. No, that's a lot of work. That's a lot of work. And that was something that, again, that we discussed as the school year came out. So if we were to move into those type of models, to hire more staff, and that's more money that's coming out of the pocket of education. And then we still haven't dealt with the issues that were in education prior to COVID learning anyway. So just like Brother Steph, you're not sending me out there as a worker bee just telling me I'm going to do X, Y, Z. We're not doing that. Nah, we're not doing that.
Yep. I figured as much, because I'm like, I mean, in the elementary schools and stuff like that, they're giving folks that idea. And I actually mentioned this on the last conversation where it was like, you know, they're like, how do we do remote learning and in-person learning? I was like, you know, what if, you know, you guys are in the classroom teaching to those people that opted to do in-person learning. And then it's like, you got like a Zoom screen on the one side of the classroom where the people who are doing virtual learning or remote learning are now watching that same lesson plan, you know, but just digitally. But then that presents this whole nother level of technological complications. You know, I have lag at the house, or my internet's not as strong, or I missed this because I couldn't connect, or, you know, whatever. Then it's like, you got to wait for the kids who want to answer the question on the Zoom conversation. They're on mute, and you got to wait for them to turn the mute. And, you know, it's just a lot of extra complications. So Brian, I agree with 100% what you're saying. There isn't another level of added stress that will be put onto you guys, added level of work. That will be put onto the professors and the teachers if they were to try this hybrid sort of, you know, remote in-person at the same time learning structure. But it's just like, it's one of those things where, you know, I just don't think we even need to be having the conversation. Like, in-person doesn't need to be happening. We're not ready yet. Just like we weren't ready to open the country, you know, we're not ready to open the schools. And what baffles me is like this idea, like I saw a meme on Facebook the other day that was like, people expect, you know, kindergartners to follow these rules and directions when we as grown men and women can't even follow social distancing and wearing mask rules, you know, and they're like, but they expect kindergartners to follow these rules and procedures. And I was just like, yeah, that's a valid point. You know, so it's like the fact that we have to even sit here and have this roundtable discussion about this and have all these concerns and issues lets us know that we're not ready yet. Why is this not evident to people? I mean, obviously, because they're seeing dollar signs and they want parents out of the house and kids in school so they can, you know, be back in the workplace and all that. But it's still just, to me, it's just baffling that they would even be having this conversation, that like considering using our children and our professors and teachers as guinea pigs to see if the country's ready for school again. You know, that to me is, that's despicable to me. So I guess the next question I have, I want to direct this to Akil, because I did say I was going to, you know, hit you with this question earlier in the show. You know, you said that you're teaching teachers how to teach. So for you as, you know, an instructor, what does that look like for you now? I mean, I know you probably have had to change your technique or your guidelines or your what have you, but what does that look like now with COVID in place? Like, how are you now teaching teachers how to teach, or has that changed at all for you?
It's going to change, because now it's more of a, while when I was in the classroom, of course, I'm modeling behavior, yeah, and like everything I'm doing. And a lot of times that, you know, I've gotten pushback from that, from some students, because they don't understand what I'm really doing. What I'm really showing you is like, okay, this is what you're going to have to do. So there might be some activities or assignments or things they'll have to do in terms of doing presentations that they just don't really see the value in it, because they, you know, they just kind of, some of the students just want to sit there and just have me just pour information into them as if like, you know, I'm the, you know, sage on stage, you know, and when I'm like, listen, like a lot of you kind of are not even comfortable at public speaking, and you expect to be, you know, classroom teachers and stand up in front of 20 people. Or if you're teaching elementary school, you're going to be responsible for like 20, 25 people on a daily basis. So you're going to have to get comfortable with public speaking. So yeah, I'm going to make you do presentations like almost every class, and you're going to have to put the presentations together, and then we're going to have conversations, and I'm going to critique, and I'm going to give feedback and whatnot. Now that we're not even in the same space, now all that has to be done online. I'm still working through and trying to figure out like how that's going to look, because I got to know for myself, like how am I going to do that better? So I don't really have a good answer for that question. Because I guess my answer would be that that's something that I'm still figuring out as I go, you know, before, you know, and even when the semester starts, yeah, even with all the planning that I've been doing this summer, when the semester starts, that's when you're going to realize, okay, well, no, that's not going to work. Or, okay, this might work. Or, okay, let's do some more of this. And then a lot of it, we really won't be able to know if it was effective until the end of the semester. So we're looking at like November. And then, you know, in retrospect, we look back and say, okay, well, how did this go, and you know, or whatnot. So yeah, this is a big, it's a big experiment. And we just, you know, hope for the best, and we just, you know, stay diligent and constantly reflect on a daily basis after every class, reflect, you know, from week to week, so we can make those adjustments on a weekly basis. But overall, we have to do the assessment, you know, at the end to kind of see.
Again, we come back to that same thing that Steve said earlier, you know, build the plane as you're flying. I feel like, though, if you were to really nail this down a little bit, like if you were to really drill it down and be like, this is how you need to do it, or these are like some of the ways, like if you were to, I know you're like, you're not going to be able to really tell to the end, but if you had several different types of teaching style for COVID learning, you could make quite a name for yourself, you know, as like a resident expert on teaching during COVID. That would be interesting to see.
And the thing is, too, like I expect to see people that claim to be resident experts at COVID teaching. I expect that, you know, that branding to come out very soon. I would question.
Start seeing the Facebook ad for it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, yeah, you know, a COVID teaching expert, and you know, it's you know, but again, some people, you know, they're trying to get a bag. So you know, you got to fake it till you make it. You know, if you tell somebody, oh, I do this and I did this, you know, if your advertising is good enough, people will believe it. And it's not to say that everybody that says that they're an expert at COVID teaching is not an expert at COVID teaching. I think there are probably some people out there right now that are probably experts or will be experts at COVID teaching just because of like requisite skills that they already had that are very ideal for this situation. It's just as they say, like, you know, some people realize that just like with students, some students fare better in a virtual learning environment. Some students are worse. I think there's some teachers that fare better in a virtual learning environment and some are worse. Just like there are teachers that, you know, maybe the teacher that is very well versed in the technology and how to do things where they don't have to really deal with human beings, you know, and it doesn't have to be as interpersonal. They might probably do great, you know, but then some other people that are like, I want to be able to sit in the classroom and look you in the face and have a conversation and like talk about this topic and then ask you questions and then, you know, engage and have dialogue. And, you know, I want to get everybody involved. And, you know, you're on a Zoom call and you can forget that, you know, it's like, okay, so you're looking at the four people in the gallery view, or maybe you're not doing a gallery view, maybe you're doing a small thumbnail. And you might forget about the other 20 people that are actually in the class and you're only engaging those four people because they're right on your screen. And then you're caught up in your lesson and you're just flowing with it. So yeah, a lot of things to think about.
And I think honestly, that was kind of a trick question, not really a trick question, but really like a trick statement, because I don't think anybody can be an expert in this right now, because number one, like we mentioned earlier, none of us have lived through a pandemic before, unless you are much older and you were around for some of these other ones. At this point, you're probably no longer teaching, though, or props to you if you are, if you've lived through other pandemics or whatever, and you're still teaching. But none of us have lived through a pandemic before. None of us have lived through a pandemic with this technology, which is the other thing. Those are two very different variables that have never been the same before. So you can't really necessarily be an expert in this, because it really is, like you said, it's trial by fire. You're learning as you go. You know, the only thing you can do is be like, you know, tried and true. Like, this is something that I've tried and it works, and for now this is good. So expert, not so much, but definitely maybe like a go-to person for expertise on how to do it. Like you said, yeah, like if you've got a set of skills, or, you know, like Liam Neeson, you've got a set of skills, particular set of skills that make you good at this, you know, this could work for you. But yeah, I don't think there could be an expert in this field right now. But one of the other questions I wanted to bring up to you guys was this idea that, okay, so we've talked about you guys going back into the classroom and what happens if a teacher gets sick. Now we got substitutes, we have other people coming in. There's already a teacher shortage. You know, we've already got 60 plus kids in a classroom. You know, we've got teachers that are way overstretched because they're throwing as many kids as possible at them at the same time. We're already in a teacher shortage. Do you think that with COVID being around and with the supply versus demand of how many teachers are needed to truly social distance and educate at the same time, do you think that there's going to be a decline in quality teachers coming out of some of these schools? Like, they're going to just be like, hey, listen, you got work, your brain works. You can breathe. Great. Hop in this classroom. Do you think we're going to be a little bit more lax in letting teachers, you know, get into these classrooms and educate our children just for the sake of having people in the rooms? Or, you know, does that not apply, do you think?
I think that it might allow, initially it may create a space where there's more of a free-for-all, so to speak, but I think as time goes on, it has the potential to really separate the, you know, those who are best at connecting and communicating information with those who have just typically been about, your body's in my class, here's your exams, here's what you're supposed to know, and get to it. And because if we're all just faces on a screen at this point, it's about what you're doing and how you're connecting and how you're inspiring. And so if your students you're no longer signing into your class, or, you know, they're popping in and they're popping out, or their screens aren't even on and they're not engaging visibly, those start, at least in my limited experience in this virtual space, you know, those are some telltale signs of, you know, you're not doing what could be most effective for your class. And so as time progresses, there may be an opportunity to really, you know, distinguish who are those educators that are really thriving in this space and then could teach others and build upon those practices too. So
yeah, it's a good point.
So what I've been working on with some people in my network is like a guide to COVID learning. So one of the things that we are actually addressing is, how do we teach teachers at this point in time? You know, from classroom management to levels of communication, the way that they need to design their lessons, both for virtual and at home learning. When I mean at home, like you're physically doing the stuff. yeah, it's going to be difficult. And that was one of the reasons why I brought up earlier about how do you take a seasoned teacher that maybe has not used a lot of technology and then shove them into this space where you're like, hey, you got to use all these apps, and they're overwhelmed with the flip phone. So those are the things that I'm thinking about. I'm trying to remember the initial question that you asked. Can you give it back to me again, the initial question?
Yeah, I just said, you know, with the supply versus demand, do you think that the quality of teachers is going to change based on how badly we need, you know, people to teach the children now?
I'm going to say up front, yes. I'm going to say up front, they just need bodies and they just need bodies in position. And then after we have the bodies in position, like Brother Steve said, I correct myself this time, they can begin to look at, okay, who's the data processors? Who's the teachers that can really keep the attention of the students? Who's really good at communicating? And then those little small nuances or growth areas, as I should say, that everybody's been working on, we can begin to really bring those to the top. So in a way, we are being allowed to, we are teaching each other by addressing those growth areas that overall a lot of us may be lacking. So I feel like this is definitely a space for innovation. And really, the folks that are able to put a stake in the ground and create some type of foundational stones will be the ones that are going to capitalize on this.
Yeah. And you know what's interesting is, like, for a while there, obviously we haven't been in school in a while, us folks, like we've been out for a minute, even though you're teaching in it. For a while there, teachers started to lose their creativity, to be honest. They started, because there are so many standardized tests, there are so many requirements that teachers are teaching for now. Like, you know, we're not teaching you so that you learn. We're teaching so that you can pass this test. Or we're teaching you so that, you know, we can hit a certain benchmark for our school. And for a long time, the creativity had been stripped away from teachers for the ability to create lesson plans that were actually engaging and were actually fun for kids, because they got bogged down with these mandatory requirements from states and local, you know, legislatures and all that kind of stuff. I think what we're going to see now is almost a renaissance of creativity from teachers who are now the emphasis is going to be placed, like Steve said, on, are you engaging the students? Are you being creative? Because no longer are we teaching to see, you know, we're going pass fail at this point. So we're not really caring about A's, B's, C's, D's. We're looking at engagement. We're looking at effort. We're looking at kids really paying attention to what's going on. And so I feel like we're going to see a renaissance of teachers and creativity with lesson planning and really truly engaging students, because it's going to be one of those things where we need to make sure that kids are plugged in. And they're paying attention and they want to be here, and they're not just popping in and then popping back out again, or they're not just no camera on, you know, but they're there and they're on mute, you know, that type of situation. So I think, you know, while it could be one of those things where, yeah, we kind of open up the floodgates in terms of let's get these bodies in place, I think we're starting to pull the stopper out on some of the creativity that teachers had to sort of put on the shelf for the time being, because they were so preoccupied with teaching for the standard and standardized tests. So I'm a little excited to see what shakes loose from the tree and what kind of comes from it, because I think there could be some real beautiful reinventing of teaching that comes from this, you know, and maybe I'm just being a real or an idealist or a dreamer or whatever, but I think there's some positivity that could come from this, you know, this need for teachers and this need for creativity at this point. So I'm a little excited. That's just my thought process. So I guess my last question for you guys, or one of my last questions for you guys before I give you an opportunity for closing thoughts, is just, how do parents help you guys? Because right now we're talking about the teachers and we're talking about, you know, what you guys have to do to transform your classrooms and transform your lesson plans and, you know, really cater towards the students. But in what ways can parents help you as educators to do your job? You know, like, what would be helpful for you from your students' parents, if you will, in whatever way, shape, or form that you want them to facilitate?
So I'm not teaching students that have that type of parental engagement, because I'm at the college and then at the colleges, and then the night school is really adult learners. So I'm dealing with parents, you know. But if I was, I would say that I think to be an added layer of accountability. But when I say that to say that really should already be the case. There are many reasons why that's not the case. And I think it's due to the concept of in loco parentis, where the school really takes kind of ownership of the parental responsibility. And the thing is, a lot of times, like in a lot of the conversations, like it that's used as a criticism of parents without, you know, giving grace to the fact that that's really like systemic. It's really like how it's set up. Like, you know, okay, there's this, like, in terms of Western education, there's this idea where, okay, like, you're not intelligent enough or able-bodied enough to educate your children. So the state apparatus has to do that for you. So you basically, you're giving over ownership or, you know, the supervisory rights, you know, almost parental rights to the school, right? When it should be reversed. The parents should be the primary educator. And I think in formal school settings, the teachers should be supplementary instead of the other way around. And now we have a situation where I think we can move toward that. And I think we're going to have to move toward that because, like, in a lot of circumstances, like, the teacher will not be, you know, online on Zoom, like, for 8 hours. You know, there's going to be a lot of asynchronous learning going on. A whole lot of asynchronous learning. Meaning assignments will be given and the students will be responsible for the completion of the assignments and for understanding the material. So I think that it's going to have to be, you know, parents can really take it, not even just parents, but guardians, older brothers, older sisters, old heads, uncles, aunts, grandmom, whoever, somebody from, you know, the people on your block that are trustworthy. It's going to be like all hands on deck. And, you know, everybody's going to have to be like, you know, put chipping in to try to ensure that the young people are able to learn. So I think that would be very helpful to teachers. Yeah, definitely very helpful to teachers, you know. Just having them, you know, having the parents, you know, be more active and also for the teachers to create and provide parents with tools so that they can be more helpful.
Okay.
You know, to the learning process.
Okay. I like that answer. Brian, I'll let you go. Don't worry, it's fine. We got 19 minutes for you to go nuts.
Listen, I've been really good. Compared to how I normally talk. So what can parents do to help teachers? I know I've been like barbaric with that. So I'm like, parents need to do all this stuff. And I also recognize in this stuff or in the ways in which I want parents to step up that there's just difficulty in that period. But definitely, you know, the community, I think, so to go beyond just this conversation, what COVID is going to do is increase the demand of responsibility in communities. I think that's what it's going to do. And that's what I started to gain from what Brother Akil said. Who else is going to teach them when we're not around? And that's what it's going to boil down to. Like I was talking about before with the intellectual currency. Who in their community, in their home, in their family has a body of knowledge that can assist me with what I'm learning in the classroom? Because you can't just be uncle such and such that just floats around anymore. You can't just be auntie that just does stuff. Auntie, uncle, grandma, somebody got to have an area of expertise because all of us might be coming over for tutoring from you. That's what it's going to boil down to. So We have to, we're definitely going to have to look at the, like I'm going to keep saying it, the intellectual currency, the experts, those stakeholders in the community that know the bodies of information that we're going to need for all these different levels. And then we're going to have to learn to work together. Like that is just a byproduct of this. All that abrasive apprehension that we had before, either we stick together and we figure this out, and I got to remember that we live, or we fall. We are going to fall. So to piggyback, we need to create best practices for our target demo. That's what we need to do it to better engage us at where we are. As far as the teachers helping us with those issues that we're bringing to them. So we're talking about SPED students. We need help in this fight too. We can only give help from our perspective. And then when we give it out, they're the ones that's giving it back. So it's going to be a cycle. It's going to be a give and take. It's not going to be one person ultimately helping the next person. We might have to have a parent come in and teach a class. That's what might have to happen. We find the leaders, the business owners that can create transferable skills. That's what I really wanted to get to. Right now, we're in a really big headspace where we need transferable skills. Our students need to be able to take what they're learning in the classroom and carry it out. So if I'm teaching my students about how to cite evidence and how to determine what truth is, they need to be able to do that on any piece of information that they're looking at, whether or not it's a website, it's a book. I talked enough. I addressed what the parents need to do for us. I addressed what we need to do for the parents. And I filled in some gaps about some things you may be overlooking.
The only thing I was going to say to really add to what Akil and Brian said was really about the piece on accountability and family being within the space. So like, if you have, but I have definitely often heard of, you know, just the parents who are, you know, sending their kids off to school, you know, they're getting them out of my hair, they're in school, they're learning, and the school is kind of like this send away, and parents get able to go to work, do whatever they need to do. But if school is in the house, and depending upon who's in the household or what the work schedules are like, the opportunity for parents to be just as engaged in their child's learning, or in the learning of the young folks in their house. I mean, you know, not often do parents get the opportunity to sit in on the classes that their students are in. So, you know, whether it's on camera or, you know, off camera, and they're just sitting on the side, but, you know, really engaging, asking questions, you know, of their child in the moment, you know, questions that the teacher might not be asking, questions that the child could then ask of the teacher that helps to make the lessons more robust for everybody else in the course. I mean, I think that, and it kind of touches a bit on Brian's larger point around parents possibly even becoming teachers or content owners of certain things that are happening in the schoolhouse. I mean, there's just a lot of opportunity for it to go beyond just sending my kid to a school or to an academic institution. They're learning what they're supposed to learn. They're out of my hair. They come back as a more well-rounded individual, and our day keeps moving on. I think there's really an opportunity for more connection, more community learning, as well as just a community engagement and presence in the K-12, specifically the K-12 academic space.
What would be really cool to see as an onlooker, because I'm not a teacher, of course, would be like a family project. You know, when you guys talk about parents getting involved and investing in their kids' education, like creating a project where the student has to work with their family on something. You know, you have a family presentation on whatever it may be, you know, whether it's like you guys have to reenact something, you know, but the whole family gets involved. If you got a full family, cool. If you have a small family, that's fine. But the project is the students, you know, the student's little end project for the year, but just allows the family to get involved in what they're doing and stuff like that. I think that would just be a real cool thing to see, honestly. I'm just throwing that out there. But we're going to get ready to wrap up the conversation. What I do want to do is give you, all three of you, the opportunity to give some closing thoughts. If there's anything that we didn't cover during this last hour conversation that you really wanted to mention about this entire situation and education and COVID and all that, I want to give you the opportunity and open up the mic for you to share that information. And also kind of we'll end the show and give you the opportunity to give your contact information if people want to follow up with you and connect with you. If you have anything you're, you know, promoting, products, brands, et cetera, I'll give you the opportunity to share that as well. But for now, I'm going to open up the mics to you guys to share your last thoughts on this conversation about, you know, education on a higher level and COVID.
I'll go first just because I don't know, my internet and everything might cut out. But for me, I think I just one thought that I've had consistently throughout this pandemic and virtual space is really about those who are teachers and educators of the arts, specifically like drawing, painting, music, theater, dance. They're so in person and so for some of those mediums, hands on, and thinking about the potential of, you know, how can we continue to create new generations of artists that can almost be as supported academically in their upbringing as generations prior were. I mean, I would hate for there to be this lull or a moment of, you know, a lack of, you know, robust artwork, you know, variety, however that is, music, art, it's a visual art, et cetera. I mean, I don't even have really, you know, any formulated opinions yet. That's just something that's swirling around my mind constantly, the importance of art and how we can make sure that we're continuing to give lifeblood to that in our academic institutions.
I was excited to have Stan on last week as a music teacher because I'm like, that's a hands-on class. Like you can't just, you know, like music, you got to play an instrument. So how do you recraft your syllabus to be virtual as a music teacher? You know, how do you recreate gym in a virtual, you know, a virtual space? How do you recreate art and all that kind of stuff? So the arts courses and you know, we're seeing theaters shut down, Times Square is shut down, which was like all Broadway is shut down, which is insane. You know, like these are examples of what you would be showing students of like, you know, hey, you want to be an actor, this is where you can go. And it's like, now this is all shut down. And for somebody who's in the arts herself, you know, drawing, painting, you know, was my thing. And I wonder, like, if I was in college now as an art major, I'd be like, what? Like, what if you don't have, I mean, you'd be hard pressed to find an artist who doesn't have paint. Like, that's hard to find. But like, what if you don't have the supplies and the space to do what you need to do and to create what you need to create? You know, like the arts and these courses are outlets for these kids. And I've talked about this numerous times on many different shows with educators about how they were cutting budgets across the board. And the first budgets they cut was always the arts. It was always music. It was always gym, not gym, but it was always music and you know, art, painting and music or singing and all that kind of stuff was always the first to go. And now it's like you're looking at this pandemic and the hands-on courses are the ones that suffer the most. You know, you think about Connecticut School of Broadcasting, where I went when I got, you know, certified in broadcasting. That was hands-on. Like, I learned how to do TV from running a TV camera. Like, I learned how to use a soundboard from using a soundboard. Like, it wasn't something I learned on the computer. Like, you had to actually touch these buttons and create yourself. So, you know, those courses and those educational sort of syllabuses that are hands-on, for me, I wonder, you know, if the quality of that education is going to be severely lacking. And I feel for those kids who, you know, were in those courses, because it's, you can't put a price on it, the hands-on experience. But I'm sorry, I jumped in the middle here. Brian and Nikhil, you guys have the floor to do your closing thoughts for the conversation.
Closing thoughts, I would say, this is all a learning process. You know, we're still learning. You know, this is we're learning how to teach in COVID-19, or learning how to teach in a pandemic. You know, we're learning how to, you know, implement new models, learning what models work best with what students, what situations, with what type of backgrounds, home situations. So we're just, you know, we're all learning. We're all in this together, trying to learn. We want to, like, you know, be as efficient as possible, be as effective as possible while we're doing it. But we just have to all keep in mind that we're all learning. Another thing I want to say, and this is a plug, even though I can't tutor everybody, but I do think that, and this is just something that I think should become, you know, more proliferated throughout the Black community, is tutoring and the idea of tutoring and everybody, you know, tutoring. And, you know, even people that would look at themselves and never feel like, well, that, you know, I don't have the skill set to really provide education to a young person. I mean, a lot of us do. Like, you know, there are people that, you know, went to college and it might have been an accounting major, but you could help some young people, a small group, maybe 2 to 3 young people with just, you know, algebra one, how to solve multi-step equations. Cause that might be something that you just remember how to do, even if you haven't done it in many years. I think this is really a time when that's needed. I think it was needed before COVID-19, but now even more, because there's going to be so much online work and so much online responsibility. And there's not going to be like, okay, I can't really, you know, go after school and ask my teacher how to do this, or, you know, I can't really go to lunchtime tutoring in the building and get this additional help. And sure, I could ask, you know, during office hours online, but that might not be enough, right? And, you know, so students will need that, like, that individualized attention. And I think that, you know, as a community, we should work toward creating some type of infrastructure to provide that, to supplement, you know, what's going on. Because even, you know, what's going to happen is, and I saw this in the spring, and I assume the same thing is going to happen, like, Khan Academy is seen as the industry standard and the go-to, but even the Khan Academy videos, regardless of how they're advertised, some of those videos still need to be explained. Like, I understand the Khan Academy videos because I'm a math teacher and I have a lot of experience, but a lot of students, they will look at a Khan Academy, because some people are very dismissive at times. They say, oh, just go on Khan Academy, you know, just that it teaches you everything. But then you may still need more explanation of the actual Khan Academy video. So I think that's where the, you know, the human interaction comes in. And, you know, an elder, or even not an elder, maybe just a teenager, you know, somebody that's in the 9th grade can help a person that's in the 5th grade or the 6th grade with, or a person in the 4th grade or 5th grade with, you know, multiplying and using the lattice method, you know, multiplying 3-digit by 3-digit numbers. You know, that's another thing that, you know, that we a lot of times don't think about, young people helping young people, We often think of only adults helping young people, but that's something from the Philadelphia Freedom Schools model, where you have like teenagers, you know, junior servant leaders and student leader and servant leader interns, you know, helping the young people. So I think that's something else that we're going to have to do, like make tutoring more of a standard. Yeah.
And Brian, you are the last to give your closing thoughts. And when you wrap up your closing thoughts, you can give your contact information of where folks can find you, follow you, and engage with you. And then I'll go through and let Akil and Steve do the same thing.
Okay. So definitely, first and foremost, thank you for inviting me. Fellas, thank you for participating with us and me being able to participate with you all and just learn. I really enjoyed the conversation, and the fact that you highlighted, which totally went over my head. Yeah, we are only represented by 2%, and there's three of us here, right? My closing remarks would just revolve around the at-home environment for the students. It's a lot. That's all I can say. It's a lot, and I'm really mindful of what students and parents and caregivers are going to be going through at this time. You know, to add another layer onto it with SPED, to add another layer onto it with the creative arts. I mean, these are just not things that every teacher, every educator is thinking about right now. And then, you know, you have an increase of reliance on the at-home environment. I think that right now is really being highlighted. What parents actually put in work and pay attention, and what parents don't put in work and don't pay any attention. And of course, that could be attributed to many different reasons. So that I'm looking at that. And then also, as Brother Akil said, too, you know, this is a learning process for all of us. We're all going to be striving in a lot of different ways. What I want everybody to take back from this is that we all learned something about COVID. We all learned something about COVID learning that we can take back to our networks and our communities. The one thing I will ask from each of you is, what is something that you would suggest for a teacher, a freshman teacher, who's walking into the COVID learning environment? What are some suggestions that you have for a freshman teacher, zero experience, walking into the COVID learning environment? Yeah.
You want us to answer that question?
Yes.
Okay. I have a couple. I have some paperwork here. I can answer some questions after. Thanks. I would probably say that we're living in a slow motion trauma, collective trauma time. So people need to be frequently checking in with each other, no matter what that looks like, whether it's a call, whether it's a voice, you know, a video chat or whatever. But just remembering as you're entering into the classroom as a teacher that this is traumatic. You know, these kids as a freshman, that means you're dealing with high school seniors who are just coming into college. That means these kids have missed their prom. They've missed their high school graduation. They've missed their senior skip stuff. You know, they've missed all of that stuff that your high school builds you up to expect and to be excited for. They've lost loved ones. Some of them may have lost friends. They've been isolated from a lot of their family and friends. You know, they lost their last summer of high school, and they're coming into college, and it probably looks a lot more different than their original, you know, idea of college was going to look like, you know, checking in and social distancing and checking in with a mask and, you know, or whatever, even sitting in a college classroom with a mask looks different than what they were expecting. So just remembering that, you know, this is slow motion trauma that these kids are dealing with, and making sure that we're checking in with these students mentally and kind of like, yeah, giving them the benefit of the doubt and understanding that like there's going to be some acting out periodically. There's going to be some upset feelings. There's going to be some rough patches because these kids are learning just like we're all learning at the same time as them. And they're dealing with some heavy duty stuff that, you know, as young kids, you feel like it's the end of the world. Like, oh my God, I missed prom. As adults, we're like, you'll be okay. But as kids, like prom is it. Like prom is like your thing. Like that's like the end all be all of high school. You know, as an adult, you're like, you know, there's other things that are important. But like as a kid, you know, some of these things seem like they're the end of the world. So a lot of them are dealing with this trauma and they haven't really figured out how to put that together and how to, you know, compartmentalize that and really deal with that. So just keep that in mind as a freshman teacher that these kids are dealing with a lot right now. And so are you. So give them the benefit of the doubt, mentally check in, give them time to get accustomed to everything and just, you know, don't take everything too seriously for the first couple of weeks and just give everyone a chance to settle into a healthy groove before we really start you know, drilling home some things with these kids. That's all I will say.
One of the things I would say to a brand new teacher is, in this environment, is try your best to master the technology. Know what technology you're using and master it so that you can make the, so the technology will become a non-issue. Because there are already a lot of challenges you're going to have anyway, in terms of, you know, how to teach, how to deliver instruction. I mean, any of the four domains of the Charlotte Danielson model, whatever model you want to use. So, but if that's something that it seems like you can, I mean, unless your Wi-Fi goes out, you know, you can control, you know, your laptop. You can control how to navigate through, whether it's Google Meet, whether it's Zoom, whether it's, I don't know, GoToMeeting or whatever the platform is. Just try to master the technology, you know, in terms of whether if you have friends and you can create like fake meetings and, you know, just navigate through them and use all the different features and do all those different types of things. So again, so you can make, so the technology can become a non-issue. It's just like, okay, I know the technology. So if the challenges that I run into are not going to be from something that I could have practiced with previously. So that's one thing that comes to mind. And I think, like, what would I tell a first-year teacher? Yeah, master the technology, and especially in this situation.
Yeah, and just to jump on what he said there for a second, too, I think confidence goes a long way. You know, like, if you go into a classroom confident with the technology, the students will mirror that confidence for you. You know what I mean? Like, it'll go a long way in teaching the kids and establishing yourself as the teacher in the room is to, even if you're, you know, just new with the technology, like he said, master it as much as you can and be confident in that classroom with the technology. If nothing else, be confident with the technology. And I think that that'll go a long way in just creating an atmosphere of as normal as you can possibly get in a learning atmosphere with the kids.
Yeah, the only thing I would add to just the answer of that question is making sure that you're centering your students and that it's not just becoming an information dump. And you're just dropping all this content on them and then expecting them to know it, making sure that they're as participatory and connecting it to their own lives as best as possible can help to go a long way too.
I agree. Well, folks, we got to wrap up the show here. Brian, did you want to throw something in there as well, or was that just a question for us?
Oh, no, that was my question to you all. I've been talking about this same topic since we got here, got on quarantine. And I mean topic as far as suggestions for new teachers, COVID learning guidelines, things like that. Like, I keep having this conversation every day. So I more so wanted to glean it from you all. I like some of the things you said, ensure your classroom isn't an information dump. I think that's really going to be important in regards to, you know, understanding who's a quality teacher and who's not. Because if you just have students just going out in the field and teaching themselves and you're not a reservoir for guidance, then just really another person that's in the room. Like, you're just giving them curriculum and not really doing anything. Jamie, to also go in to what you said you need for me to do to drop my contact information. So for those that want to reach me, you can reach me by email, b.carter@maincoursephl.com. You can check out our website, www.maincoursephl.com. It is the same name on all social media platforms. Get me on Facebook, b.carter. And to close out my part, you know, looking at the time, you know my line, be safe, be true to yourself, be real always, is an FMSB Rizzo signing up. Glad to participate with y'all. And that's how I end my classes.
All right, Steve, you're up next.
So you can hit me up on LinkedIn, Stephen with a PH, Tyson Jr. You can follow me on Instagram @elect, ELLECT 217. And you can also just follow another one of my accounts, Hip Hop is Voting, @HipHopIsVoting. Just to stay updated on everything that's going around in the hip hop community and social atmosphere around the country. So, yeah.
All right. Akil, last but not least.
Yeah. So I typed my information into the chat. My email address, akil.latef@gmail.com. Well, it's in the chat. Also, allthismath@gmail.com. Also, allthismath, the Instagram page. And when I'm building, there will be a YouTube channel, a more robust YouTube channel coming soon, where there'll be more and more content, just worked out problems. Because in terms of culturally responsive pedagogy, that's another, you know, conversation, you know, that's a more popular conversation, but something that we perhaps can get into at another time. But when I go online to do research to look for, you know, even myself, like when I need to brush up on some topic I haven't taught in 10 years or, you know, something that, you know, a student needs help with and I'm too responsible for tutoring them in, I go and look up a video and I'm like, okay. And, you know, it's a lot of white people, you know, not a lot of brothers, not a lot of sisters, you know, teach math, but there are brothers and sisters out there that can teach math and that do teach math. And that's one of the things too, that, you know, again, online content, we have to build more online content. So that's one of the things that I'm going to be doing in terms of developing the YouTube channel for all this math. So, you know, the young people will have, you know, a space to go to where they're comfortable, you know, and they feel like someone's speaking their language, somebody they can identify with, you know, the same way anybody does. Also on Facebook, Akil Parker, my government name. Yeah, so that's pretty much it. But yeah, and if anybody can have as many young people as you can, go and have them follow the All This Math Instagram page. Because what I do is I take requests. They send in problems. I work them out live.
Okay. Cool. I want to thank you for taking the time to be with me today, for sharing all the stuff that you've gone through and that you're doing with your students. I really appreciate it. If you guys want to follow me or get in touch with me or the radio station, of course, we're WJMS Radio on Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, and Twitter. You can also follow my Facebook page, which is Jamie Jam on Facebook. And I'm, Just _ Jams on Instagram. So you can follow those two accounts there if you're interested. If you want to be a guest or if you want to reach out to any of the hosts here, please feel free to get in touch in any of those ways. I appreciate everybody tuning in today, all your comments, everyone who hopped on and streamed with us for the hour and a half. I'll be back next week with another brand new episode of Sound Off. This time we'll be talking with people who are recovering from COVID and some of the lasting side effects that they're experiencing, from young adults to old adults, because there are some long-term side effects to battling COVID that I don't think people are aware of. So we're going to talk about the process of recovering from it and what it looks like after. So be sure that you're here next Saturday at 12 p.m. I want to thank the folks behind the scenes that make WJMS Radio possible. Thank you guys for all your hard work, especially my team of interns. Shout out to the folks over at Double Mint Radio. If you haven't had an opportunity, please check them out. They're our newest partner that we're working with. Yeah, we got plenty of content on WJMS as well. Brand new show airing on, what time is that? At 4:30 today for the Gray Area. So make sure you check that out later on today. Interns are doing music interviews. We got an artist interview today as well at 3:00. So plenty to listen to. Make sure you're there. Keep it locked. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode. Until then, everybody stay safe. And we'll see you next time right here on WJMS.
WJMS Radio.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Far too kind.
See, we keep it real. We always gonna keep it real. You can't knock what's real, you know what I'm saying? We telling the truth, man.